Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host Eagle One from Eagle Speak. Greatly appreciate you taking time this afternoon to spend with us. As a reminder to those that are joining us live, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, you'll see a link to the chat room. If you have some observations about the show, some questions you want to offer, that's a great place to go to. Both Eagle One and myself will be monitoring that during the course of the show, and we will look forward to bringing in your good ideas. Also, if you're new to Midrats or you want to catch up on some shows you may have missed, you can get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio. Or if you would like to have a little more efficient way of getting the show after hours, you can go ahead and go over to iTunes and subscribe to the podcast. Now let's get on with the show. We're going to address today some broad concepts, some important concepts. When you think about naval power, things such as power projection, sea control, access to near shore seas, denial, and the ability to impose your will on the enemy from the sea, or depending upon which navy you serve, preventing others from doing the same. If the comparative advantage of American military power includes the use of the world's oceans as a basing area for projecting power and national will, how do other nations design systems and tactics that can trump that advantage that we hold? Where are we right now, both intellectually and materially, to address that? And where do we see the future trends heading on our ability to do what we have taken for granted since the end of the Second World War? We have the ideal guest today to discuss this and perhaps a little bit more. It will be Sam J. Tangredi, Captain, U.S. Navy, retired. He is a defense strategist and a futurist. He had a 30-year naval career that included command at sea, service in key strategic planning positions in the Pentagon and overseas. He's also earned a PhD in international relations and has had research fellowships at two think tanks. He is rather prolific with the written word and has over 100 publications out there for you to dive into with the joy of Google. They include four books, one of which I have in my hand that I have signed by him last year, Anti-Access Warfare Countering A2AD Strategies, where we're going to get a few of our questions from today. And he also has won some awards for his work, including the U.S. Naval Institute's Arleigh Burke Prize and the U.S. Navy's League Alfred Thayer Mahan Award. He is currently the director of San Diego operations for the planning consulting firm Insight. Sam, welcome to Midrats.
Yep. Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be on.
Just kind of set a real broad horizon, and I touched on it a little bit in the intro. If you look at the post-World War II era and how the United States have operated, we've been involved in some not insignificant conflicts, Korea, Vietnam, the two largest, of course. For the endurance, we've had the Long War since 2001. There's been various other smaller actions we've been involved with. But during the Cold War, besides the planning that we did for those huge backfire regiments coming across the horizon, are that rather substantial numbers of Soviet submarines, we've never really been challenged at sea since the Imperial Japanese Navy in the Second World War. And the discussion of anti-access area denial has been a topic recently, because we are starting to see, again, for the first time since the Cold War, the ability for others challenges in that area. And besides the discussions we're going on, have you seen a renaissance intellectually of looking at this topic, and not just looking at it and talking about it, but perhaps looking at how we're training and equipping our fleet in order to respond to this reemerging challenge that we're seeing at sea?
Well, to answer your question, first of all, one of the reasons I wrote the book, The Anti-Access Warfare, Countering A2AD Strategies, is because I didn't think there was a lot of thinking going on. What we have is we have the Air-Sea Battle Office, but quite frankly, not all of us know too much about it because they've been very quiet about it. And some people say, well, it's not really people thinking about the overall strategic problem, but people thinking about particular tactical aspects of the problem and how the U.S. Navy and U.S. Air Force could best cooperate. My work is different, and the fact that I look at anti-access warfare as a strategy of potential opponents to the U.S. for the exact same reason you've been talking about in your question. We've had absolute dominance at sea. The potential opponents know that. They know that it'd be very difficult to challenge us in the blue water, although China is working on some capabilities to be able to do that. What they want to do is to deny us access to the region in which they are. The lessons learned for most of those nations come from the 1991 Gulf War, in which we built up power in the region and we utterly decimated the Iraqi forces. And the then Soviet commentators wrote about, and what the Chinese military commentators wrote about, is they really chastised Saddam for not trying to keep the U.S. out of the region, for allowing it to build up its power and then strike. Their takeaways from that is, you don't want the U.S. to get a foothold in your theater. You don't want the U.S. to get a foothold in your region. You want to keep them out. Once they have the foothold, the U.S. is going to defeat you. So their whole anti-access strategy is about keeping the U.S. out of the region. Now, going to your question about whether or not we are thinking about that, tactically, I think we are thinking about countering those techniques and those systems that can be used in an anti-access strategy. However, I don't know if we're thinking about it in the terms of how to counter it in an overall campaign or how to think of it as something more than just a naval operation. Anti-access strategies incorporate the you wouldn't say whole of government approach, I hate that cliche, but it involves the total forces, both political, economic, as well as military, of the potential opponent into forcing the U.S. out of the region. I lay out the problem, I say there are five fundamental elements of an anti-access strategy. And the first one, which as I just discussed, is the perception of the strategic superiority of the attacking force. And that is the nations learning the lessons of the Gulf War. If you let the U.S. into your region, and that could be using regional bases, having arrangement with regional allies, bringing naval forces into the region, if you do that, you're likely going to be beat, because overall the U.S. will retain strategic superiority in the global sense. Why? Because it has an alliance network with many nations that potential opponents do not. Potential opponents are generally, theoretically, I mean, are generally isolated in that sense. Now, let me take a little, I know you've got plenty of questions, but let me take a little side trip here. My work focuses on what I call wars of necessity as opposed to wars of choice. Wars of choice are wars in which we elect to get involved when they don't necessarily, if we lose, it doesn't mean destruction of our global power. It doesn't mean threats to our position in the world. Wars of necessity are wars that we will have to fight in order to keep our position in the war, in the world, or even protect our own sovereignty. And there are only four possible opponents, and those are the ones that I focus on, because those four opponents would use some anti-Axis strategy. And the four opponents are People's Republic of China, Russia, North Korea, Iran. Those are the ones that we would fight the war of necessity against, and those are the ones that are trying to apply the technology and military doctrine they have, anti-Axis strategies. And it doesn't just mean attacking U.S. naval forces. It means forcing U.S. allies in the region to maintain their distance from the U.S. It is about intimidating those nations around it using political and economic means. I mean, Russia wants to intimidate the nations of its periphery, of its near abroad, by the potential cutting off that natural gas. All these tactics are anti-access in the sense that you're trying to prevent U.S. forces from having access to your region. Now, I don't use the term area denial. I use anti-access, and for a very specific reason. To me, area denial, which talks about access on the battlefield, is part of natural war fighting. It is. I mean, you always try to deny the opponent the ability to have mobility on the battlefield. That's area denial. I focus on anti-access, which is about keeping U.S. forces, primarily the U.S. Navy, because our connection to all these regions are through the maritime space. So it's preventing the U.S. from being in your region. And so my first fundamental element is that those forces, that nation, the potential opponent that's trying to apply an anti-Axis strategy, perceives us as strategically, so they want to keep us out of the region. So it's a good thing that they have these strategies, because if they thought that they were strategically equal, then they would design their forces to just beat us in a force-on-force engagement in that situation, anti-Axis strategies are useful, but they're not critical to your success. And what we need to do is have a counter anti-Axis strategy. And we're not there, because I don't think we're looking at it as a strategic problem, looking at it as a tactical problem. China has more submarines now. We need to reinvigorate ASW. They have the potential anti-ship ballistic missile. Well, we're thinking about how to counter that. My view is we need to do a lot more work in deception. Now, most of that is highly classified, so it's hard for someone not involved to know what's going on there, but I think that's a critical element. And there's one area that in terms of systems that we're not taking seriously, and it's absolutely critical. We need to develop effective anti-satellite weapons. That's an issue, a holdover issue from the nuclear confrontation, nuclear deterrence during the Cold War. The arms control industry did not want the U.S. to develop effective anti-satellite weapons, because the theory is that it would threaten the national technical means that the Soviets could monitor our nuclear weapons so that they wouldn't shoot because we weren't shooting and that sort of thing. That era has passed. China is working very hard on anti-satellite weapons. The reason we need to work on it is to conduct an anti-access strategy at sea, you need sensors. You've got a tough tactical problem because you've got moving targets. What you need primarily is space-based sensors. We need to be able to knock down those space-based sensors, as well as protect our own. So that's one area that we need to be focusing, and I don't see a lot of discussion on that. And it's because the current administration brought back a lot of the old arms controllers of the Cold War into DOD positions, well, mostly Department of State positions. They bring their old theories about balance. They don't recognize that era has changed, and we need to work in that thing. So that's a long answer to your question. and I'll turn it back over to you.
Well, it was a good answer. Let me go back to some basics here. When we you start out the book talking about the Greeks against the Persians as an example of early anti-access. Could you, just so we can catch everybody up on where your thinking comes from, talk a little bit about the Greeks and the Persians and why that got you started off on this anti-access argument you make?
Yes. The book starts off contrasting two examples or the two things that influence our thinking about anti-access. And the first one, the Greeks versus the Persians, is all about the first anti-access strategy that we have a written record of. And this was the by Xerxes as the emperor of the Persians to conquer the Greek city-states in 480 BC. Now, Xerxes had a tremendous force. Some say 150,000 to 200,000 warriors. The Greek city-states were not united, and each city-state maybe could have a force of, at the highest, 10,000 hoplites, but most of them just a few thousand. So they knew that if Xerxes' force could operate with impunity in Greece, they would all fall. Now, what they thought about was how do you keep Xerxes' force out of Greece? Thucydides, the famous Athenian navalist, his first idea, which they did not enact, was stop the Persian forces from crossing the Dardanelles from Asia to Greece. The Persian forces crossed because they built a bridge of nested boats. And Thucydides, with the Greeks planning, they know the Persians are coming, said, you know, what we should do is sail our ships and destroy the nested boats. Then he can't bring his forces into Greece. We've stopped him from entering the region. Now, the others, the Athenians, this was a weird thought to them, so they didn't support it. So what he did was he took the Athenians and Spartans up to an area called Tempe, where there's very narrow path. Well, we would call it a canyon that he could use to prevent the Persians from crossing if they could contain them at narrow pass. That didn't work because the Greeks were now aware that there were other passes that flanked them. Then the famous battle of Thermopylae was fought by the 300 Spartans, very famous, under Leonidas. That was part of the campaign to prevent the Persians from coming into the center of Greece, because, you know, once they did, the strategic superiority of Persians were such that the Greek city-states would fall. So this is development of anti-access strategy. Now, the Persians actually got through the center of Greece. The Athenians forced the others to fight alongside them at the Battle of Salamis, naval battle. They took control of the sea lines of communications, and that's what really cut Xerxes off. He couldn't feed his force. So, but the whole thing was an anti-axis campaign, and that's why I derive from that, you know, what I call five principles of anti-axis, or five fundamental elements of anti-axis. The first is the anti-axis nation, that is, the state or the force that's creating an anti-access strategy first perceives that the attacking force is strategically superior. It's gotta do something. If that force enters their region in force and they go against them in a force-on-force battle situation, the anti-access force is going to lose. So it's got to do something. The second fundamental element is the primacy of geography as the element that most influences time and facilitates the attrition of the enemy. And that's what the Greeks were trying to do. You know, prevent them from getting through the Tempe Canyon, or stop them at the narrow ribbon of land, which was Thermopylae, prevent them from coming and getting close to the cities. The next element is the general predominance of the maritime domain as conflict space. Why is that? Because in the Greek example, Xerxes could not resupply his force except by sea because it takes so long to move those supplies by land. And he had such a vast army, they couldn't live off the land without pretty much using all the resources. Pretty soon all the resources are gone, so they had to be resupplied by sea. Once the Greeks had control over the Aegean, they could not resupply the forces, so Xerxes had to go back. And so they were able to defeat the anti-access part, was denying him the freedom of the seas, the sea access to the region. The army was there. It was there in force, and in fact, they burned Athens to the ground, and all the Athenians went to the island of Salamis, and that's where they fought the great naval battle. But and that's another thing that points out why anti-access strategies are difficult to enact and achieve success. But anyway, they could deny the access via sea. Xerxes could not get supplies. The other, the fifth element, well, let me talk about the fourth element, is the criticality of information and intelligence and the decisive effects of operational deception. That really, no one really had operational deception initially in that campaign. The Greeks had absolute intelligence about the Persians because Xerxes broadcast it. He wanted the cities to surrender without a fight, so he told, you know, he let everybody know how huge his armies were. He captured Greek spies. He'd let them go because he wanted to impress everybody with the size and strength of his army and his strategic superiority so that they would just surrender. But anyway, in the anti-access struggle, that information intelligence is critical. And then operational deception plays into that greatly. But the fifth one, and this is the one that is a challenge to the United States, too. The fifth one is what I call the determinative impact of extrinsic events or unrelated events in other regions. In the case of the Greeks versus the Persians, Xerxes has an empire with a lot of vassal states, a lot of countries he defeated. The Greeks were able to stir up some revolts within the empire. Xerxes is there campaigning in Greece while revolts are starting up in Asia. Then, at that point, his calculus was that it was too much. It was too much of a bother to defeat the Greeks. It was more important for him to retain control over the territories they already had control in. So there's great incentive for him to leave the region and go back. Now, how that affects the U.S. is if we ever get into a conflict with an anti-access a state that employs anti-access strategies, one of the things they'll try to do is break our concentration by fomenting events somewhere else that will influence us. That's why Vladimir Putin loves us being involved in Syria and Iraq, because he can do things in Ukraine, and we're too busy. That's part of the situation. Now, I'm not saying that Putin had the ability to influence events there, but certainly take advantage of it. And that's a natural thing. And that affects the counter-anti-access power, the strategic superior, because usually, just like Xerxes, they have global responsibilities, or they have responsibilities greater than just fighting in that region. So they have to make the choice. He had to make the choice. Did he want to bring greater forces? Did he want to hire more naval forces from somewhere else to defeat the Greeks? Did he want to apply the force to destroy their cities quickly, despite whatever casualties might be involved? Or did he just say, this situation, the cost-benefit analysis is such that I don't want to spend my resources defeating the Greeks. I'd more like to use them going back and suppressing these rebellions, whether in Asia Minor or elsewhere. So, and that's one of the elements of it. So an anti-access strategy incorporates those five elements. And so that's why I begin with the Greeks. I begin because that's the first example. We have a substantial written record. I'm not saying that the strategy wasn't applied earlier. just we have, you know, plenty of writers in that era writing about it and analyzing it, and we've learned from Herodotus, Plutarch, Thucydides. I said earlier Thucydides, but Themistocles, who was the Athenian navalist. Thucydides was the great, was also an Athenian admiral and general who was recording the war between the Athenians and Spartans. But it's Themistocles who was a great genius of the Greek defense against the Persians.
Now, Sam, that's one of the great things I like about your book, the is the historical nature of it, because we have seen in the last few years, and the cover of your book, Anti-Axis Warfare, Countering A2AD Strategies, it has that great pic somebody have of one of our CBNs on the receiving end of, you know, pick your future or now weapon of choice, your anti-ship ballistic missile or cruise missile. Some people get real excited about, oh, this is a new threat. This is, you know, this whole concept. We're not thinking about it. When, you know, we've got a few thousand years of other people, very smart people, who have looked at this challenge. Yes, the tools have changed. The speed has changed, but the concepts are very similar. And in chapter 5 of your book, you brought up one of my favorite topics, mostly because it's really, even though it's from the early 80s, it's really the most modern case we have of war at sea and one nation trying to deny seas to another. And it's in chapter 5 where you outline three anti-access defeats. And number 3 of your 3 is the Falkland Islands conflict. What does the Falkland Islands concept, the Falkland Islands war, what does that tell us today, and what are the most important lessons we need to make sure that we inculcate as we look forward to what we need to be preparing for?
Okay, before I answer that, I just want to comment on your comment about the fact that a lot of people looking at anti-access warfare as a new phenomenon. And my view is that you have to view, if we are going to be successful against a state or a force, it can be a non-state force, that applies an anti-access strategy, we have to look at it as strategy, overall strategy, and how we would defeat it using all of our means. If you just look at it as new technologies like the anti-ship ballistic missile or stuff, you try to defeat that tactically, all you're doing is you're chasing an evolution in warfare. I mean, you're saying, okay, there's a new threat, let's figure out how to counter that. That's fine, but the whole anti-axis approach is about using a whole variety of means. However, those means have a logic to them, and the way to defeat the opponent has a logic to it. I mean, the very first thing you do is you destroy their sensors. So they can't see your maneuver at sea. There's a wonderful Chinese phrase used in one of their ancient texts. You cross the sea without heaven's knowledge. That is, you've denied the opponent from seeing you cross the sea. I like to apply it to satellite, you know, anti-satellite warfare and satellites. You cross the sea without their satellites seeing you. And so anyway, going to the Falklands and applying, you know, the principles that we're talking about. The anti-access situation was this. The Argentines have captured the Falklands. They applied strategic force, strategically superior force within that region to capture the Falklands. What? They've got, you know, up to 12,000 troops in the Falklands. They knocked off the 45 Royal Marines or captured the 45 more Royal Marines that were there. Now they've got it, and they want to prevent the Brits from coming back and taking it back, from coming back in the region. Great Britain's a long way away. They've got to sail our armada down there. So what are the sort of things that Argentines do? Well, first there's the diplomatic thing. Galtieri, who is the leader of the junta, believes that he's got good relations with the U.S., so that the U.S. might not support Britain in doing that. He was wrong. The U.S. gave a lot of intelligence to the Brits, shared intelligence with them. You know, President Reagan certainly supported Prime Minister Thatcher. And so also the Argentines appealed to the world because they claim that their struggle was anti-colonial or it's anti-colonialism. But most buy that. Even Chile, who next door, provided intelligence to the Brits, too. The countering the anti-access is the Brits have to bring their forces back into the region. They don't have any forces ashore. They don't have any regional bases. They've got Ascension Island, but that's thousands of miles away from the Falklands. They've got to figure out a way to get into the region and recapture the islands. And in contrast, Argentina has to apply an anti-access strategy to keep them out of the region. So what did the Argentines do? Their most effective weapon was, of course, their aviation units. They wanted to attack the British carriers, seeing that as the British center of gravity. They actually couldn't do that because the Brits were very effective in their naval warfare tactics. They have a picket line of destroyers. They're using deceptions. Argentine don't have assets, don't have space assets. They don't have access to the information to pinpoint the British forces. Argentines also want to use their submarines, but they're outmatched there too. The British, the first thing the British deployed were their SSNs. And unlike the Argentines, the Brits had great communications between their forces and their headquarters. For part of the conflict, the Argentine forces in the Falklands had very poor communications with their headquarters. In fact, the Argentines were so confident that the British would just accept everything as a fait accompli, and there would be some sort of face-saving diplomatic maneuver, and then Argentina would hold on to the Falklands, and the Brits would give up. The Argentine commander on the Falklands never really expected to have to fight. The Brits entered the region. The Argentines could not keep them out. The Brits had superiority. Brits were strategically superior on a global basis, and that was demonstrated at the fact that they could take their navy, sail it over 10,000 miles to the Falklands, conduct a campaign, and defeat the opponent, and that's what they did. Now, there's lots of factors involved. Argentina had a conscript army. They were being led by a military junta, which most of the world considered odious, dirty war against its own citizens. The motivation of the average Argentine soldier to fight for the Falklands was pretty low, and that's why most surrendered. But the amazing thing is how Britain was able to defeat all these attempts to keep it out of the region. And that's why I like that example. And some of the tactical aspects, the one that stands out to me is the Brits had so much, was so superior in having tactical intelligence. They knew, and the Argentines did not know. That was a lesson. The other thing was that maritime dominance is what allowed the campaign to happen. That's why the maritime realm and naval forces are such a critical element in countering any anti-access strategy, because the first thing you need to do is get there. And if you, you know, you may have to put boots on the ground, but you have to get them there. And the anti-access powers, the force using the anti-access strategy is focusing on preventing you from getting them. Argentines could not prevent the Brits from getting there. Once the Brits were there in force, they defeated them in detail, the Argentines in detail. ASW apparently was critical. There's still not a lot of information about ASW, except we know that the Brits fired off a lot of ASW weapons on phantom targets. But there had to be targets there because, the Argentines were not able to sink any of the British ships. Supposedly, there were, according to Norman Friedman, some of the Argentine, at least one Argentine submarine actually fired torpedoes against British ships, but none of them hit or none of them exploded. The Brits were very good in defending their high-value units. And when the Argentine aircraft came over the horizon to strike those units, usually they fired at the first target, and that was usually a destroyer. So that's the Brits took losses. And that's another thing about modern war on that level. You've got to take losses. This is a war of necessity, in a sense. Now, for the Brits, you could argue that this was not a war of necessity for the Brits, but the threats that I see facing the U.S. are wars of necessity. The Brits, in that case, did want to defend their global position. The Argentines to take what was British territory by force, a territory in which all the inhabitants considered them British. It was not an anti-colonial situation at all. All the inhabitants considered themselves British. They allowed that. What would happen to their global status, their global power? What would happen next? So, in a way, you could see that as a war of necessity. Did I answer your question?
Sure thing. Over to you, Gowan.
Yeah, I noted that the four powers you see as a anti-access, if you will, threat that the U.S. might have to confront, all of them are authoritarian regimes. I note that early in your book you talk about why anti-access is so appealing to authoritarian regimes. Could you kind of run over that for a minute?
Yes. You see, authoritarian regimes spend most of their time denying access of their own people to information, denying foreign influence from coming into their nation. I mean, it's so natural for them to look at building barriers. The ultimate, the ultimate barrier was the Iron Curtain. You know, the Soviet Union didn't want the connection. They didn't want their people to escape. They didn't want economic influence of the West affecting them. So as they look at military strategy, kind of from the same perspective, we need these barriers to retain our control of power. It's natural for them to look and say, okay, the U.S. could defeat us. How do we want to approach it? We want to build a barrier. And the barrier in this case would consist of an anti-access network. And then, you know, the sensors to detect the U.S. fleet coming in the region, various weapon systems to try to strike them at long range, coastal defenses, all that is part of it. But it's part of a mindset. It's also on the opposite direction. It's not something that democratic governments think of because they're all into the flow, free trade, free exchange of ideas, commonality. Here's the thing that I find interesting because I study international relations, have great difference with the way that's taught at most universities. In the 60s, international relations, the professors all wanted to turn it into hard science, so they did a whole bunch of number crunching on how nations react to each other, and that still spills off in the way people think of great power politics, both the liberals and conservatives, focus on that, but one of the people that were in the in this number crunching that ultimately failed was asked. His name was Modelsky, his professor emeritus at University of Washington, was asked, all this number crunching, what did it actually prove? And he said, it proved the democratic democracies don't fight other democracies. They just don't, because there's no need to. So in a conflict, what is the future conflict going to be? It's going to be a democratic state versus authoritarian state. And it's natural for the authoritarian states, who want to hold on to power, want to expand their power, it's natural for them to come up with strategy to prevent the number one democratic state from preventing them, and that's, of course, us. So the whole mindset is geared to building barriers. In fact, my working title for the book was, and obviously it's alludes to the People's Republic of China, but my working title for the book was Breaking the Great Walls, because what we need to do is we need to break through the great walls that the anti-access powers, which are generally the authoritarian powers, are building to prevent us from being able to defeat them in the event of any hostilities in the region. And so the Great Wall of China being kind of a motif. And the Great Wall was not designed simply to prevent the barbarians from coming into China. It's also designed to cut off the Chinese so that the dynasty can consolidate its power. When the first Chinese emperor tried to, put the wall together to turn it into a great wall, he did not have absolute control over China. He's trying to cut off China from the world so he can consolidate control within it. At the same time, he's trying to prevent the barbarians, and not in this case the Mongols, from coming through. And what I suggest is how a lot of the authoritarian anti-access states were defeated was pressure from the outside, plus people from the inside to revolt, and the wall actually imploded rather than was exploded, so to speak. So anyway, to answer your question, it's a natural mindset for authoritarian power to think in terms of building barriers, and that's going both ways. And that's one of the reasons that the whole anti-access strategy is, kind of psychologically appealing to them.
Yeah, let me follow up on that, because you mentioned that the Chinese have these three warfares, and one of them is the legal warfare, which and I think under the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, they're trying to assert that they have a 200-mile exclusive economic zone, which includes the right to exclude any military vessels and aircraft from entering that space. Is that just part of the anti-access writ large? Is that preparing the ground for extrinsic event that they can argue that somebody violated their 200-mile EEZ?
Yeah, that's both. Number one, it's trying to get the U.S. used to not having their naval forces within 200 miles of China, and trying to get that enshrined as a legal principle. And the second thing is to make a plenty of noise at the UN and others so that the U.S. approach it cautiously. We will have plenty of U.S. diplomats and people on that side who will say, the Navy's going to be provocative on this issue if we keep these freedom of navigation operations continuing and the like. There's always people to try to placate the aggressor because they think that somehow doing so will change their behavior. Now, I have to admire the Chinese in this case, and they're in a wonderful position because they don't believe any of the international conventions, but they're willing to use them rhetorically against those nations that adhere to them. China, recently we've had this agreement, pseudo agreement that was negotiated about avoiding close encounters between naval forces in the South China Sea. And what was marvelous about it is China agreed to it, and then the very next day a Chinese spokesman said, in effect, we will adhere to it when we feel like adhering to it. Now, my problem with our whole approach to it is we have plenty of people in the U.S. government in a position of authority that actually think that they are going to get the Chinese Communist Party to adhere to these agreements. They're not. It's kind of a elitist attitude. It's kind of, I think of it, a very elitist attitude on the part of the Eastern foreign policy establishment in the U.S. to think that somehow we can manage the Chinese Communist Party behavior so that they will agree and be a responsible stakeholder and act the way we are. The Chinese are as smart as we are. They're sending their kids here to university. They know how we act, how we think. And quite frankly, the Chinese Communist Party, being ultimately a Leninist party that believes in centrality of power and doesn't believe in democratic institutions as we do, and doesn't really believe in adhering to treaties when it's inconvenient to them, we're not educating them, you know. We're fooling ourselves. And so in the case of dealing with them, their efforts are to keep us out of the region. They can do that by getting other nations to agree with them on how to interpret the international law of the sea to prevent U.S. naval forces from getting within 200 miles of them. Then they've achieved, you know, a result in building their barrier. And that's a successful aspect of their anti-access strategy, because we won't, in peacetime, have the knowledge of that region. We won't be in a position to counter any swift moves of theirs. And ultimately, their focus is to retake Taiwan, to reunify with Taiwan as they view it. Clearly, they want to keep us out of the region so that they could do that when they feel like doing it, if they feel like doing it. So to answer your question, yes, they apply lawfare. They don't believe in the law, but they're perfectly willing to argue it in world forums in order to counter nations that do believe in the law. And that's what they're doing.
Speaking of authoritarian nations, we'll have to give you the Mitt Romney Award for talking about Russia before it was cool to talk about Russia. In Chapter 9 of your book, Central Eurasia, Russia, and the Near Abroad, you brought up a term there I wanted to give you an opportunity to flesh out, because I find it interesting. I think one of the weaknesses that can be from somebody in uniform is you always go back to where you were the most comfortable as a kid, which is thinking about the tactical level, which is weapons and tactics and looking at a chart on the map, et cetera, and so forth. And, of course, if you're a history geek, it's fun to look at history. But you used a term there that I think, with what we're seeing, what Russia under Putin's leadership is engaged with in eastern Ukraine, that I think is very much at the top of his mind and probably a lot of others, and that's political anti-access. How is that done, and where can we see where Russia might be able to employ that political anti-access in this hybrid non-war that he seems to be having a preference to use?
Well, yeah, and the political and the economic are tied together. Russia wants the West to accept the fact that those nations on its periphery are under their control. You know, Putin has often said that the collapse of the Soviet Union was a catastrophe for Russia, because you get all these, all the nations that supposedly were independently volunteered parts of the Soviet Union actually independent. And when they're independent, they can make treaties with the U.S., they can sell their resources to Western companies, they could pretty much do what they want in that sense. And Putin wants to reverse that. And the way he does is several ways. One is to let those nations know that the people in the West aren't going to defend them. You know, you have to come to accommodation with Russia. And that accommodation will include some sort of treaties, tight economic connections, and, oh, by the way, turning your back on the Western connections. And so he's using the ethnic Russian card. That is, he's obviously during the Soviet, well, not so obviously, but during the Soviet Union time, the Russians, and this is what the Chinese are doing now too, moved a lot of their Russian or ethnic Russians into the various unions that comprise the Soviet Union, And so what you have is a lot of them left there once those nations declare their independence. And he's using that. The argument is that they are being picked upon, or they're minorities whose rights are being infringed, and he's got to go defend it. It's completely reminiscent of the Tsar involvement in the Ottoman Turkish provinces, when he says, you know, the Slavs are being picked upon, they're second-class citizens. We will defend the rights of the Slavs, therefore we will intervene in Turkey. And eventually those nations, such as Romania, Bulgaria, and South, achieved their independence, with knowing that at that time, anyway, that Russia was their patron. Now, Putin will use the rhetoric of the West as far as minority rights. He will use economic coercion. He will do whatever he can to achieve those results without having to actually involve in war. And because the U.S. is involved in so many other things, you know, we're not focused on that. Would he challenge the Eastern NATO nations in that way? I don't know. But I think that in the back of his mind, he thinks he could put a lot of economic pressure through cyber war and other ways on the Baltic republics and stuff. He wants to get the U.S. out of the region in any way he can. This is an anti-access strategy. And so he's going to use political and economic means. He knows that if it came to a war, force-on-force conflict, U.S. forces are going to defeat him. I mean, they will know that. So how do you prevent that? You try to get the U.S. out of the region using political and economic means. And you know, he's doing that. And that's why my study's focused on those four, because those are the ones that want the U.S. out of their regions so they can achieve the goals they want to achieve with a minimal force. You know, I mean, Iran, you know, sees itself as defending those Shiites and wants influence wherever Shiites are. Well, who's going to stop them? Obviously, the Sunnis might try, but, you know, on a larger scale, going to be able to do that with their, you know, mercenary forces. So the only people that can prevent Iran from achieving its goals is the United States. And so logically, you want to get the U.S. out of the region, however you can. Same thing with North Korea, same thing with China, same thing with Russia. And, you know, again, I find Vladimir Putin very instructive, because there were so many people in the United States and the intellectual communities and our intellectual lawyers who argue, well, we'll educate him and we'll educate the leaders of China and stuff how to be responsible stakeholders. These people don't want to be responsible stakeholders. That's not what they're about. And it's time for us to understand the anti-access threat as a strategy to neutralize U.S. influence, to remove U.S. influence from many of the global regions of the world, which we've been involved with, to do that through whatever means, whether it's lawfare, economic coercion, and other means. They want to get U.S. allies to disagree with the U.S. and not get involved. You know, they've applied that pressure to Germany with some effect concerning the potential cutoff of natural gas. Germany is doing some things to diversify its supply, but it's trying to convince those nations, you know, if you support the United States and its endeavors in this region, you will suffer consequences. And you might suffer consequences while the U.S.'s attention is elsewhere. You know, Ukraine, you want to be Western-leaning. Well, you know, U.S. attention is elsewhere. NATO doesn't want to get involved with the war in Ukraine. Ukraine is not a NATO member. You know, you have to bend to our will, our policies. Elsewise, you're going to suffer the consequences. That consequences might be a deliberately incited insurrection of the Russian minority. Those consequences might be an actual incursion, such as in Georgia. Those consequences can be a whole lot of things, which is why all those, not all those nations, but many of those nations want to be NATO members, because, you know, they want protection from the United States. They want protection from the other NATO countries. And one of the reasons that a lot of NATO members are reluctant to have them join the group is because they don't want to get in a war against Russia if Russia is going to get involved in those places. It's not in their individual national interest. So, again, I hope I answered your question in talking about Russia. But, again, it's relying on the anti-access strategy because, A, it views the U.S. as strategically superior in a global sense, you know, and B, it knows that geography, that's got to use geography in this case, the eastern Ukraine, it's a demographic geography, that is the great Russian ethnic population in those regions. It knows that the maritime domain is going to be primary conflict space because we're here, they're there. We need to use our Navy to get from here to there. They're aware of information intelligence as a critical element. They're going to use deception. They're also going to use lawfare and the various things in order to create extrinsic events that take our attention away from what's going on the ground in that region. So they understand this, and that's what their strategy is all about.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you one of the counters to anti-access warfare. Seems to be having a strong enough fleet to pose a threat to let the other guys know that if they really are serious about trying to keep us out, we can push our way in if we have to. What in the world are we thinking about with the 50 plus littoral combat ships that we're looking at getting that I'm not sure would be much of a threat to a low-grade Coast Guard, but is that a mistake, or should we be looking at more robust combatants?
Well, that opens a whole different that would be a complete program on its own. And this is my personal view of LCS. At the time that the decision was made, I was working in and out of OPNAV, and I really was one of the people that thought it was a very, very bad decision. But you have to understand why the decision was made. The decision was not made, and this is during CNO Clark's tenure, the decision was not about what the ship could provide. It was simply about numbers. We wanted a certain number of warships. It's too expensive to build. You couldn't afford the destroyers that were making. At the same time, SecDef Rumsfeld wants transformation. What that is, nobody knows. But this thing seems fairly transformative. LCS is certainly different than what the U.S. had. Anyway, LCS has been a failed program throughout. It is completely a mistake, except in the sense it can be effective as a Yangtze gunboat. That is, we could put it out there in Singapore, and they could be the tripwire. And if the Chinese starts sinking them, then we know we're in a real war. But they're completely ineffective. They can't do the missions they're assigned. We talk about the anti-surface warfare module. The anti-surface warfare module is kind of a little, BBSS? I mean, now, let me talk about experience when I was defense attaché in Greece, because this is very illustrative of this. At the time, a rep from NAVC, we were trying to get other nations to sign up for LCS. The very fact that none of them will tells you something about the program. But the NAVC briefer contacted me, and I told him, look, you're going to brief LCS, and the first thing the Greek admirals are going to ask you is, when are you going to build the AAW module? You're going to tell them, we're not building any AAW module. Then the admirals are all going to look at their watches and decide they need to be someplace else, because that LCS has nothing to offer them what they view as the critical elements that they want. And the guy says, oh, no, everybody's got, the U.S. is building the LCS, everybody's going to want it. He gave a brief, and that's exactly what the Greek admirals did. But one actually told him the truth about it. He said, the missions that you have in these mission modules, we can do all of those missions cheaper with what we have. You're talking about surface warfare. It's kind of a VBSS sort of landing SEAL stuff. We got small craft to do that. You know, we've got patrol combatants. That's what they could do. You're talking about mine sweeping. Well, you know, a specialized mine sweeping craft with newer technologies could do that cheaper. You know, and you're talking about something, your ASW is kind of like Tagos Light. You know, it's not tactical ASW. It's kind of basically they said, you know, we could do all those missions cheaper with more specialized platforms. Why in the world should we buy LCS? And oh, by the way, you know, and this is something I believe, you know, you can't change the missions of that ship quickly because, A, you know, the ship's crew needs to be trained in what the new mission is, or B, you know, you think you could just yank it off and yank it on the different mission packages and then operate right away? No way. You know, it's not going to be changing out mission packages in a couple of days. It's going to be changing out at least in a couple of weeks or longer because of all the elements involved. You know, NAVC himself, I forget if it's the current NAVC or previous NAVC, argued, well, you know, these ships are modular, and of course, you know, our most modular ships are aircraft carriers because you could fly in and fly out a mission package based on the mix of the aircraft you have on it. Well, that's true, but you're not going to fly in and fly out mission packages on LCS. You know, LCS was a bad idea from the beginning. Now we're stuck with it, so we need to figure out how to use it. I have no idea what the answer is of this small surface combatant study that they're trying to brief out to SecDef as far as that. But if it involves the LCS, then we definitely have to up-gun it. The LCS is not Street Fighter. I had talks with Admiral Sobrowski about that concept. It is not Street Fighter. His concept was a ship that had high striking power against shore targets. LCS does not have high striking power, even against sea targets. You know, if we wanted to use it effectively, we're going to have to figure out how to put the follow-on harpoon on it, how to put a major weapon system on it, and realize that we're putting major weapon system on a relatively cheaper platform, although not as cheap as it was supposed to be, and we're going to use them as strike weapons, and they're going to take a lot of hits, but they're like the first wave of our capabilities. And the other failure of the program is quite this, and the previous PEO of the LCS program, his name escapes me right now, but at a conference program, he says, what's your biggest problem? And he says, the biggest thing that plagues me is that $240 million price tag. That is what the program was originally announced as being able to do. Now, we spent over $600 million per ship, and we still don't have the capabilities. He says, you know, that was a bad estimate. That was a bad estimate from the start. Plenty of people told the CNO that was a bad estimate at the time. They went with that because to get congressional approval, but he said, you know, we would never have been able to build it for that money, for that amount of money. And then that was the logic of why we built SAS. At $240 million per copy, we could build three or three and a half for every destroyer we could build. Well, guess what? We can't even build one and a half for every destroyer we can build, unless you build Sumwalt. But Sumwalt, versus a Sumwalt, but Sumwalt is an incredible overextended program too. But no, LCS, does it have anything to offer in an anti-access situation? If we put a good deception package on it, like we did in the Cold War, that it can mimic an aircraft carrier, you know, by sending out all the electronic signals and stuff, and we put them out there, then they can serve their purpose as alternative targets.
Otherwise known as the naval tethered goat. I tell you what, Sam, I keep waiting for the navalist version of P.J. O'Rourke to write a novel about the birth and life of LCS, because it really could be a tragic comedy for a lot of the reasons you outlined right there. I tell you what, it's been a real fast hour. I greatly appreciate you, Kim, taking time to come on. What are you working on right now, and what can we look forward to seeing for you in the future?
Well, I just completed an edited volume for Naval Institute Press on international naval cooperation. This is part of their Wheel Book series that they're launching in January. What they're doing is they're taking all the top proceedings articles on particular topics, and they started with leadership, tactics. For the tactic one, they got Wayne Hughes to be the editor for that. I'm doing an international naval cooperation, which is, you know, basically about the thousand ship navy and partnerships and all that, and collected. And the whole point of the series is to explain to professional naval officers and outside people what this whole thing is about. So I've done that. It's completed. I'm hoping that they're ready to work on it and get it ready for next spring. But I also, under contract, and I'm really excited about this, is I'm doing a study on aircraft carriers in the 21st century, in which I actually try to compare them against the alternatives, not simply ships, but aircraft carriers versus land air bases. Which are better to invest in? You've had Jerry Henricks on your program, and I like Jerry a lot. He's a personal friend. But when he wrote his study for CNSA, for Center for New American Security, about carriers, he begins by saying, "Well, for the same money, the Chinese can buy, 100 and something anti-ship ballistic missiles." But that's a bad comparison, because it would be good for them to just spend the money on that, because you need the combat system. You need the sensors, and that starts costing you billions of dollars. So what I found when I started the study, I thought what I do is a meta-analysis, which in medicine what you do is you collect all these studies on the same together, and you study the studies and find out what they agree on, what they disagree on. And that's what I did for my previous books on the future of war. But what I find is, there aren't any good studies on this subject, any good current studies. There are studies by Rand about whether you build a Nimitz class or you build a Ford class, but there's nobody who's tackled the thing on and says, hey, which is a better choice, aircraft carriers, land air base? Which is a better choice, a whole fleet of LCSs or aircraft carrier? And this is my final comment about LCS and its role and the whole small surface combatant in narrow seas, which supposedly LCS about. Admiral Sobrowski once said this to me, or in preparation for a conference, he says, maybe the best surface combatant for the littoral is an aircraft. And I apply that to the carrier. It's not the carrier's fault that we bought short-legged. But you put longer leg aircraft, and like the A-6 was that could conduct a war at sea, and maybe that's what we need as a littoral combat platform rather than building LCSs. So, and that's where the aircraft carrier comes involved in it. Aircraft carriers, the issue with them is the range. It's range of the aircraft, not the aircraft carrier itself. Anyway, that's what I'm working on now. I haven't got it done yet. Hope to finish before next year. I'm excited about that project.
Well, me too, because you're hitting on some of our favorite topics, that's for sure. And I look forward to seeing you. And we'd love to have you back on to talk about it once you get it wrapped up and are getting the word out for everybody else. But again, thanks a lot for joining us here today, and I hope you have a great remainder of 2014.
Thank you. It was my pleasure. I'm a big mouth. I like to talk a lot. So worked out
you're
for
good
all
company.
Hands.
Thanks a lot for being here, Sam.
Yep. Take care.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Midrats. And until we hear from you again, hope you have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Molly wrote a neat reply to Irish Paddy O, saying Mike Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the strand and pick a Billy O.